listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers, including specials like Black History and Future Series. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $17,000 goal by March 25th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you, and you're welcome.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine how Seattle became the first city to pass a new ordinance banning caste-based discrimination. Tenmori Soundara Rajan, founder of Equality Labs and author of The Trauma of Caste, who was intimately involved in the organizing, will be my guest. Then we'll turn to Colette Watson and Alicia Bell of Media 2070. About how to make newsrooms more anti-racist. We'll look at how media outlets have historically been complicit in perpetuating white supremacy and how they can change. Finally, as the Supreme Court this week hears arguments in a case over President Biden's student debt forgiveness program, Braxton Brewington with Debt Collective will explain what's at stake. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The city of Seattle last week became the nation's first to ban discrimination on the basis of caste. South Asian workers, particularly in the tech industry and beyond, have experienced caste-based discrimination at the hands of upper caste Hindus in ways that have been invisible to non-South Asians. Now, activists who passed the Seattle ordinance hope to replicate their success in other cities. My guest is Tenmori Soundara Rajan. She's a Dalit technologist, artist, and activist. She's the founder of Equality Labs, a Dalit civil rights organization working to empower caste-oppressed people. And she's also the author of The Trauma of Caste, a Dalit feminist meditation on survivorship, healing and abolition. She recently wrote a story for Yes Magazine about the historic Seattle Ordinance. Welcome to the program, Tenmori.
Oh, Jay Beam and Jay Savitri, and so excited to be here, Sonali. We did it.
Amazing. Congratulations to you. So for those of among our audience, I will certainly point you to the article that lays out how you got here. But tell our TV and radio audience what it was that led to this moment to make Seattle the first city to ban discrimination on the basis of caste. There were a lot of moving pieces. And of course, like any success and victory like this, I imagine it was years in the making.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, for folks who may not know a lot about this issue, you know, caste is a significant axis of discrimination, both within the South Asian community and across many industries that operate in Seattle and many American cities, whether it's tech, whether it's restaurant workers, whether it's building trades, whether it's, you know, domestic workers. We're seeing significant amounts of caste oppressed workers who are really asking for, you know, remedy to the kinds of grave discrimination that they're facing. And the thing that was remarkable of Seattle is that this win was a result of over 10 years of Dalit feminist organizing, bringing together people who work around survivor issues and building survivor power in the city with people who are working on issues related to racial justice, gender justice, and very crucially, workers' rights. And I think that, you know, those seeds were started in 2015, you know, with the Dalit Women Fight Tour, where our colleagues brought, you know, our allies in South Asia to talk about caste-based gender violence. And this activated a really powerful energy in the city about what does Dalit internationalism, you know, or caste-oppressed internationalism look like when it's connected to other feminist and racial justice internationalisms. And those relationships really catalyzed partnerships in the city between my organization, Equality Labs, API Chaya, which is one of the leading Asian Pacific Island organizations working around survivor issues in the city, and Ambedkar Association of North America, where for several years we worked on cases related to caste-oppressed domestic violence survivors and survivors of trafficking and you know, abuse of like domestic workers. And that partnership really is what catalyzed so many of the activated relationships that we saw go into this resolution. Because again, when you have feminist, worker, and racial and caste alliances like this, you unlock the potential power of thousands of workers and survivor power advocates. And so those folks, you know, not only work to support those individual cases, but we also mobilized to get the first congressional hearing briefing in Congress with, you know, Representative Primala Jaipal. Also, Equality Labs did the first survey around establishing that caste existed in the United States. And that data, coupled with the incredible stories of Seattle-based organizers, was really incredible, especially since we had a coalition of over 200 organizations from around the city and the nation right in. We also had major unions that also came forward, including the Asian Pacific arm of the AFL-CIO, APALA, as well as the Alphabet Workers Union and the Tech Workers for Caste Equity Workers Collective. And then crucially, 20 different caste-oppressed organizations from all across the country, including Ambedkar Association of North America, Ambedkar King Studies Circle, Ambedkar International Center, and many, many others, representing hundreds of thousands of caste-oppressed voices in North America, all wrote in and were part of the testimony process. And I think that really was what galvanized this moment. And it's, you know, to me, I think this movement is such a beacon of hope because it shows the strength of what an intercaste, multi-faith, interracial movement can do when love is unleashed. You know, we can meet the bigotry and the violence of those that want to throw us back into discrimination with love and intersectional power that is really rooted in empathy, healing, and reconciliation.
So in Seattle,
this was amazing.
I understand. So all of this, you know, years and years of groundwork nationally, but also in the city itself. You understand you worked with City Council Member Kshama Sawant, who helped to lead the, you know, bringing the ordinance to the City Council for a vote.
And Councilwoman Kashama Sawant, and also the Coalition for Indian Americans of Seattle, as well as many other gender-based and racial justice activists and organizations in the city. And what was so moving was to hear just very, very just emotional testimony. You know, I always remember, you know, the testimony of Rita from Tasvir, who came out as Adivasi as part of this campaign, or an indigenous community from South Asia.
And Tenmori, when you say came out, can you explain that? Yeah. Because a lot of South Asians who are Dalits, or hail from, you know, what were once known as the so-called untouchable caste, they live in the shadows. They live in fear of being outed, if you will, right?
Yes. And this is actually one of the crucial points about why caste oppressed workers on caste oppressed communities are asking for caste to be made explicit, is that the discrimination we're facing is quite severe. You know, in our own research at Equality Labs, we found that 1 in 4 caste oppressed people experience physical and verbal violence, 1 out of 3 educational discrimination, and 2 out of 3 workplace discrimination. And as a result, over the half the people that took our survey said that they would prefer to live in the closet than come out because they don't want to face this violence. So what was so moving about the testimony, and these were grueling, you know, public comment hearings, was that people braved rape threats, death threats, open bigotry, gaslighting, disinformation, to turn their pain into power. And I was so honored to just stand by so many fellow caste-oppressed organizers and watch them just act with such courage. And for example, we had organizers from Ambedkar King Study Circle and Ambedkar Association of North America and Ambedkar International Center stay up at 2 in the morning to give public comment at 2 in the afternoon. So 12 hours in the middle of snow and rain, because it mattered that much to tell their story. And organizers from the, you know, the Coalition of Seattle Indians, they really helped to bring together this network of folks all across the city and the country so that people could have a safe space to testify because of all of that violence. And Rita, who I mentioned from Tasvir, she had not been previously out as a caste-oppressed Indigenous person, and she came out. And as she was speaking, her voice trembled with the, you know, I'm assuming like both the fear and the courage and the tremendous emotionality of what it means to have to come out to say we need the violence to stop, and we are here and we need a remedy. And I think that was an unstoppable force, the love and the courage of caste oppressed people and our allies. You know, the Seattle City Council could not but, you know, pass this historic measure. And I think what's really important for listeners to know is that, you know, today, you know, yesterday it was Seattle, you know, tomorrow it'll be the nation, because at Equality Labs, we have been hearing requests from people all across the world who now want to add caste as a protected category because they are seeing significant discrimination existing wherever South Asians are. Right. And so it's a big watershed moment. But it's been built by Dalit, you know, feminist leaders for the last like 10 to 15 years. And it's incredible to see that work, you know, just blossom in the way that it is.
So let's talk specifically about the Seattle Ordinance. Did it pass by a wide margin? And what does it now mean? What does it mean for Seattle to have this anti-discrimination aspect as focusing on caste within the city? How will it be enforced, applied and enforced?
Well, I think one thing that was really important is that the bill, the ordinance passed like 6-1. So there was one dissenting vote, but the overwhelming majority was with caste oppressed people. And I think a big part of that had to do with the fact that this is a union and worker struggle. And the fact that we are hearing so many prominent cases, you know, whether it's the state of California suing Cisco Corporation for caste discrimination, or in New Jersey, where we see hundreds of workers that were trafficked by the religious institution BAPS, who were called worm and paid a dollar an hour to build these religious temples across the country. Or in Berkeley, you know, where Lucky Bali Reddy, one of the largest landlords in the city of Berkeley, trafficked hundreds of workers, including 20 young girls, many of whom were minors, to be his sex slaves.
Who were Dalit.
Yes, and who were Dalit. This is why it's such a serious issue. This isn't about personal feelings or just microaggressions, which themselves are also quite serious. This is actually grave civil rights and labor harms. And so this is why this move is so historic, because, you know, with this ordinance, any caste oppressed person can come forward and file a complaint to the city saying that they're experiencing caste discrimination in their workplace, in their community institution, in their places of worship, and the city will investigate. And if the city finds harm, there will be penalties, you know, according to whatever the penalty schedule that exists related to the city of Seattle. So before, that remedy was not there. And there are actually several companies that work in Seattle where workers have been asking for caste to be added as a protected category. And I'm thinking about, in particular, Google, who has thousands of workers that work in the city of Seattle and the state of Washington. Workers there have been rallying around asking management to have caste as a protected category. Well, now there's like a huge mandate because you have one of the first jurisdictions in the United States that's asking for it. There are workers that are impacted that have already reached out to management. And now it's the onus will be on the businesses to address the severe discrimination that caste oppressed people are facing within their premises.
What has the response been like? This is an issue that Hindu supremacists have taken very personally. There's been huge pushback, often couched in terms that are deceptive or hard for non-South Asians to make sense of. So I imagine that there's been some backlash already since Seattle City Council passed this ordinance last week.
So yes, there's no question that there are people who are really sitting in their fragility around this issue. And, you know, we know that. We know that the flow of progress is always meant with those who dissent, particularly if they've benefited from the exploitation and discriminatory networks that they've created around the system of exclusion that they're operating in. But, you know, the civil rights obligation isn't about addressing the fragility of the privileged. It's about stopping grave discriminatory harm. So I think the fact that we won this ordinance and we are set up in many places where people are really powerfully activated to stop more harm happening to caste oppressed peoples, that's an incredible movement victory and a movement win. And I also think that, you know, the caste equity movement is a movement that's rooted in empathy and caste reconciliation. And so I really, you know, I want to reach out to those people who are the opponents to this issue and ask them to just sit down a little bit and slow down and listen to the testimonies. You know, we're no longer in a place where we have to say, does caste exist in North America? It's here. There is data and there are stories, and that's not contestable. However, I think that we can really begin a process of reconciliation when people are really able to start to listen with a deep empathetic witness that, okay, historical harm has existed because of caste. I can feel discomfort. I can feel, you know, worry, like, what does this mean for me? But those are feelings that you can talk through with other members of your community. Choosing to litigate your fragility, choosing to openly do rape threats and death threats and disinformation at caste-oppressed civil rights groups doesn't really actually help your cause. It actually just proves the reasons why we need civil rights protections. So I encourage them to put down the sword of bigotry and to join us, because frankly, not only are the majority of South Asian Americans in favor of caste equity protections, but also increasingly more and more Americans who are part of these really powerful intersectional collaborations that are bringing together survivor advocates, feminists, you know, racial justice and worker rights and unions are coming together on this issue. it's really an unstoppable force. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would just encourage people to join us because it's a very loving place to heal from caste. But we can't heal from caste until we ban it, because we've got to stop the discrimination from happening. So I hope that they stop and they join us. You know, the door is always open, but, you know, fragility takes a long time to unravel. So we'll see what they do.
In your story at Yes, you write, if you are not a bigot, such a policy will not harm you. It's as simple as that. So when we think about bigotry now, as you said, there's caste awareness and discrimination wherever there are South Asians in the United States. You know, it's not just the tech industry in cities like Seattle or in Silicon Valley in California, you know, or in companies like Google. It's all over, because South Asians have been in the United States for a long time. What is the future of this? Is Seattle, you hope, the first of many other efforts across the country? You mentioned that a lot of people are already getting in touch with you to see how they can replicate this in their own city.
Absolutely. And, you know, Sonali, I have to keep some secrets close to my chest, because, you know, otherwise I may not be able to see you for a while, because I know your book is coming out. But I do want to assure all of the listeners and viewers online that Seattle won't be the first. And there are many.
Won't be the last.
Yeah, it won't be the last. It's really it's such a powerful movement that's really snowballing, because the Seattle win has a multiplier effect. People that were just waiting to, you know, get up off the sidelines to step forward are now just like, you know, signing in, rolling up their sleeves and ready to build these coalitions. Because again, you know, people want to heal. You know, when you have historical violence, you know, from systems of exclusion, whether it's race or caste or patriarchy, we want to move beyond the polarization and get to a place of reconciliation. And I think what I've seen that's been so powerful in this movement is that there is another vision of what it means to be South Asian that is stepping forward, because it's rooted in looking at our historical harms quite clearly and asking to heal. And I don't think very many people have ever been in a multiracial, intercaste, interfaith coalition where that's so centered. So you have dominant caste Hindus that were formerly part of these Hindu right organizations who have said, I don't want to be part of those politics of hate. I want to connect with my people. I want to stop the dehumanization. I want to be with my caste oppressed kin. Mm-hmm. And to see that across all faiths, like we had representatives from the Sikh faith, the Christian faith, you know, Buddhists, we had everyone at the table, because again, it is so powerful to be able to heal as opposed to be in a trauma ward of, you know, fragility and bigotry. And so, you know, love won that day, and I think love will continue to win all across the country.
Finally, Tenmori, I'm always very fascinated with the ingredients for success and what it takes to put together, you know, this kind of success. People who are newly activated, maybe young folks who are interested in political activism, may not see the painstaking work that goes into creating such victories. And we talked about it earlier, but you mentioned, you know, there's now data. There was a time when there wasn't data. And so your organization, Equality Labs, did the work because you were faced with denial. There's no such thing as caste. And so you set out to prove that there was by doing the social science that was required. So there's years and years of painstaking data gathering, right? Then there's all the coalition building. There's also things like having allies in elected office who are progressive minded and social justice oriented, who will bring the issue to a place where you can translate cultural shift into policy shift. All of those pieces have to fall into place painstakingly through hard work, through sleepless nights, to achieve justice and victory, right?
Absolutely. And I think that for all those baby organizers that are listening, or maybe even those elder organizers that are watching, you know, many years of their activism being rolled back by the forces of bigotry and fascism, You know, I just want to say that this is a movement that I think can be a beacon of hope, because it was a win that really showed that you can beat back the forces of fascism and bigotry with a powerful, multiracial, feminist, worker, and caste and racial and gender justice coalition. That was the only way that we could have like pushed through something like this. And that work doesn't happen transactionally. It's not like, hey, I need this call, can I come through? This is literally about years of carrying each other's water, learning about each other's movements, breaking bread, sitting with people in both the hard times and in the times of celebration. And that's why I'm saying, you know, you can't deconstruct this win to a period of a month. It's really 10 years of relationship building. And so I want to, you know, everyone that's on the sidelines of social change that might be thinking, you know, this is such a hard time. People feel so polarized. Can I really make a difference? And I can tell you, everyone can make a difference. Everyone can make a call. Everyone can show up to an allied meeting. Everyone can break bread and serve food at a session. And there are so many different tactical change, you know, processes that go to building a beloved community around justice. And I think people sometimes think leaders are people that are up there and they're the ones that give the speeches. But actually, there is an entire web of love that goes into building people power. Because our opponents, they may have lots of money. They actually may also have physical violence, but they don't have our numbers. They don't have our courage. They don't have our love. And that's why we're ultimately going to win.
Thank you so much, Thinmori, for joining us today and for the work you do. We'll post a link to your story at Yes Magazine from our website. Good luck to you and can't wait to see what comes next.
Yes, can't wait to be back. And if folks want to, you know, join the Caste Equity Movement, please follow us on Equality Labs and join our newsletter. We'll have updates on our future campaigns. And, you know, it's always a pleasure, Sonali. And thank you so much for flanking our movement. It's so powerful to grow up as an organizer with you and also to see this work come to fruition like this. So
Jaypee
Minji Savitri and bye everyone.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Thinmori Soundararajan. She's a Dalit technologist, artist and activist, founder of Equality Labs and author of The Trauma of Caste, a Dalit feminist meditation on survivorship, healing and abolition, which I reviewed for a past issue of Yes Magazine. We've been discussing Seattle's caste discrimination ordinance, which she also recently wrote about for Yes Magazine. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website at risingupwithsonali.com by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify and follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Since the inception of American journalism, newspapers and other media have reflected the same white supremacist culture that exists in society. Often they have even fueled it. Addressing this ugly history and calling for media justice and reparations, Colette Watson of Media 2070 writes in Yes Magazine that, quote, media reparations means redistributing power and resources to realize a future in which Black people control their own stories and narratives from ideation through production and distribution. Joining me now is Colette Watson, Project Director of Media 2070, and with her, Alicia Bell, the co-creator of Media 2070. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Colette, let me start with you. And I should mention that you co-wrote the essay that YES published with a couple of others. And I'll ask you to mention your co-authors as well. But tell me what it means to first say we need media reparations. Why is there this need to address what media has done? Not just what, you know, government and communities have done, but what journalists and media have done.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I want to, first of all, give a shout out to Vanikia Williams and Diamond Hardiman, my co-authors on the essay that you mentioned. And yes, when we talk about media, we're very intentional in honing in on that particular sector of society. In our essay, which was published back in 2020 called Media 2070, An Invitation to Dream Up Media Reparations, there's a quote in that essay in which we say, media culture, rather, is the forest floor where policy goes to either flourish or die away. And what we're saying is that we understand that our culture is where we understand what is true, we understand what our shared values and shared truths are, and that cultural narratives are what shape the conditions of our lived realities, of the policies that shape those lived realities, and what's possible for our futures. And we know that news media in particular, the news and information ecosystem, really shapes what we hold as true, and that all other media, whether that be entertainment media, book publishing, even social media and tech, flow from what we consider to be true. So we know that reporting has to be grounded historically, and it has to undo so much of the harm that has taken place throughout history, particularly from the news media itself.
And so I'm wondering, Alicia, if you can give us a little bit of that history. There have been, you know, many, many instances of systemic racist coverage over generations, but it hasn't just been coverage. There have been, you know, actual sorts of calls for action in white-owned media and white supremacist media. There have been paid ads that Colette pointed out in her article for YES Magazine. Early newspapers in the U.S. published paid ads promoting the sale of enslaved African people and using that money to stay afloat. So literally being solvent on the backs of human beings. So give us that history in a little bit more detail.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, when the first newspapers were created in the United States, they were facilitators and places that were curating the sell of African people. And they were facilitators of human trafficking via chattel slavery. Because not only were they publishing ads for folks buying, selling people, kind of trying to find folks who had run away, they were also sometimes the brokers and the places for auction. So they were playing a really active role and allowing and kind of co-signing slavery in the United States. And then you move forward kind of from there into the Reconstruction era and beyond. And one of the first places where you see folks pushing back, specifically when it comes to journalism, because there's been a lot of instances of folks pushing back in other cultural ways and other narrative and storytelling ways. But we see folks pushing back by creating news organizations that were led by and serving Black people. And doing that, saying, we have to tell our stories for ourselves or they won't be told. And so you continue to see kind of journalism, media kind of being complicit in white supremacy and racism in the US. You see folks kind of amplifying falsehoods that led to lynching. You see that kind of come to a head with instances like the Tulsa massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where we have newspapers, journalism, amplifying falsehoods around Black people in Tulsa, and then kind of folks mobbing up and really taking an attack on Black lives. And so that's continued, right? It's been structural. With the FCC, the initial licenses that were distributed to white men only. And so then we see other folks kind of creating other radio stations, creating other kind of broadcast media to serve Black communities. And then that continues, right, all the way up until today. And so what we see today is we see news organizations that are being complicit in crime coverage that is disproportionately impacting Black people. We see news organizations that are lifting up harmful narratives about Black communities or are not talking about Black people at all. And that's something that's been happening for decades. So, you know, even back in the 1960s, the Kerner Commission was saying that newspapers were not covering Black communities as if they did anything besides commit crime and or be great. But there was nothing that was in the middle, like going to PTA meetings or living in homes. And we see the same thing today.
I want to hone in a little bit more on how Black-owned media tried to take back the narrative, tried to fill that void of accurate coverage of Black communities, and then received pushback. So it wasn't just that you had a white supremacist culture or have had a white supremacist culture in our media. It's that we've also had a very hostile environment for Black-led media to flourish, right? And Colette, feel free to jump in.
Sure. You know, a lot of people know the name Ida B. Wells. And we know her when I was a kid, we learn about her for Black History Month and the fact that she was an anti-lynching crusader. But what maybe isn't discussed as much as I would want it to be is the fact that she was a journalist and she laid the foundation for investigative journalism. And she used her journalism to tell the truth about lynchings. And in that way was an anti-lynching activist. She also had a newspaper called the Memphis Free Speech and Headlight. But when she published the truth about a lynching that happened locally, which the folks who perpetrated that murder claimed that it was because of an alleged sexual assault, but what had actually taken place was that these two Black gentlemen had a store that was competition for local white business people, and so they lynched them. And when she published that truth, her paper, the Memphis Free Speech and Headlight, was burned to the ground. And that was in, I believe, 1892, sometime in the 1890s. And even when you fast forward a little bit to World War I, you had the publisher of a San Antonio-based Black newspaper, G.W. Boudin, who was arrested by the United States government on charges of sedition for publishing he published an op-ed that a Black person wrote that was actually decrying the fact that the United States Army had hanged a number of Black soldiers for protecting a Black woman from police locally there in the San Antonio area. And so just in those two decades, right, those are two direct attacks. Now multiply that by the tens and by the hundreds over many, many years. Journalist L. Alex Wilson was beaten by a mob attempting to cover the integration of Little Rock High School and subsequently died from his injuries. Right on through to now, when you saw in 2020, journalists at the LA Times, at the Philly Inquirer, the New York Times, and other outlets having to rise up because, and one of the most glaring examples to me is the Washington Post, because their newsrooms don't reflect the demographics of the community, because there aren't Black and Latine reporters,
right,
and facing so much difficulty trying to tell truthful stories about Black folks. So this sort of harm has taken place, particularly, you know, against Black press and against Black media makers working within dominant media companies. And it's all the same harm. It's all connected.
And so then let's talk about how these newspapers in 2020 in particular, you know, took this massive racial justice uprising in the wake of George Floyd's police killing for newspapers to, for example, firsthand witness police brutality on the streets, and then, as you said, realize that they themselves were complicit. Many newspapers, including the LA Times, but maybe not enough, actually issued apologies. Alicia, tell me about that moment where you started seeing some mea culpas, if you will, among some newspapers, how you responded to that. Some of them even pledged to improve things, and it's not clear, you know, if they've actually done anything about it.
True. And, you know, there's been apologies. I think about even in my hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina, right? And in North Carolina more broadly, There have been apologies issued by newspapers. So the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer issued an apology for the role that they played historically in the Wilmington Massacre, which was another instance of journalism narrative and harm leading to material and physical harm against the Black people and Black communities. So we've seen these apologies happen over time, and you did see a spike in those happening in 2020, where they have the LA Times, you have folks in Kansas City, you have the Inquirer in Philadelphia kind of saying, we haven't always covered Black communities well, we haven't always covered communities of color accurately, we haven't always distributed in the ways that we have. And so when we think about kind of full repair of harm, we think about it in a few different ways. So it takes the reckoning of kind of understanding and knowing that that harm happened, and you have to then acknowledge it and move into accountability where you stop the harm. And then you also have to move into redress, where it is kind of what do we create to make sure that this harm can't happen in the future. And what we see in these newspaper apologies is a whole lot of reckoning. And then it moves into, and I wouldn't even say a whole lot. It depends, right? It ranges on the newspaper.
Why is newsroom diversity such an important issue? How can newsroom diversity translate into fairer, better, just coverage?
Great question. You know, media reparations and broader reparations is not a destination. It is a process. And we understand diversity and representation as a critical, very, very early step. Some might even say first step along that path. So obviously, we are very adamant that newsrooms need to reflect their communities demographically, intersectionally. As I mentioned, we believe that it's just the first step, because we know that without our presence there, someone else is telling our stories, or someone is filtering Black stories for white consumption. And so that compounds harm. But when we talk about the media reparations process, we know that it has to go beyond that, and that there has to be redistribution of power and resources, as you mentioned earlier. One of the people we work with is the brilliant journalist and researcher Carla Murphy, who in her report, The Leavers, found that most journalists of color were being forced out of the field right around the mid-career point when they were beginning to have access to that editorial leadership power and that decision-making power.
Leavers meaning people who are leaving.
Yes. People who are leaving the journalism industry, forced out due to lack of pay, due to toxic environments, due to being burned out, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's why we understand that it's beyond diversity and inclusion that we must have care. We must have institutional care and consideration for Black journalists and media makers, and by extension, Black communities.
Tell me about the pledge, Alicia, that you're calling on media outlets to sign to, promise to do better. I'm very proud to say that Yes Magazine, the outlet I work for that has published Colette's article and op-ed, has signed that pledge only recently. So tell me about this pledge.
Yeah, so this pledge comes out of an instance yet again where we see it came after the murder of Breonna Taylor, and where we see another instance where narrative and a culture that allows for anti-Blackness gets weaponized and into a physical material reality that leaves a woman dead and a family kind of without a relative. And so after this, what we were hearing from a lot of Black reporters and a lot of Black journalists and newsrooms is that they were having such a hard time navigating, because on one hand, folks would want to cover this story and want to tell this story, and were not being able to because they were being told by folks that they were too close to the issue, that they couldn't report on it in an unbiased way. In other instances, we saw folks who were being kind of pinpointed, and they were being told, you are the only person who can report on this, because they were the kind of token Black person in the newsroom. And holistically, what we saw in that was that folks were not being cared for, right? So people weren't able to take time off. they weren't able to utilize the time they needed to heal, to process, to be with family. And right after that murder, you know, there was a slew of other folks who were harmed. We had seen at the same time, right, a Black woman, a Black young girl being beat up by police and that being recorded. So there was so much harmful imagery and harmful video that was coming out, and it had been happening for years. And folks were not able to take time to process, were not able to take the time they needed to be well in their bodies and in their spirits and in their families. And we also saw coverage of protests, coverage of people taking direct action, of people grieving publicly. We saw that public grieving being turned into stories of criminality, stories again that perpetuated narratives of anti-Blackness. And so we issued this pledge asking newsrooms to care, right? An action that is in theory really simple, right? To care for the people, the Black folks in your newsroom, to care for the Black folks in your community, and to figure out the interplay between that. And we did have newsrooms sign on, right? We've had newsrooms who signed on initially, newsrooms who have continued to sign on to that pledge, newsrooms who have committed to care. And then we also saw newsrooms who chose to be kind of willingly obtuse, right? Who knew about the pledge because we had been in direct conversation with them. But because we issued it maybe to a group of newsrooms instead of each newsroom individually, they were like, oh, well, we couldn't sign it because we weren't asked specifically to sign this pledge, right? And that's a willful choice, right? Folks could have signed it. Folks could take this action. But when you take that public action, it also opens up space for public accountability. And folks aren't always willing and ready to be in accountability in that way. And what I will say about the pledge too is that like diversity, like representation, it is one of the steps on this pathway to getting to reparations, to getting through reparations, right? So when we're talking about care, we gave a few examples of what that looks like that were specific to kind of not adultifying Black girls and being thoughtful and intentional about your coverage of public grieving and protest. But there are so many other instances in other sectors of Black life and Black community that were not in that pledge that we've continued to build on through our work since then. And really, if to push kind of from that pledge to get us closer to reparations, to get us closer to getting through reparations to whatever else is on the other side, what we really need is for newsrooms to practice this institutional care, right? So when we have newsrooms and we have hedge funds, for example, that are owning conglomerates of media, those folks can practice care for Black journalists by not only paying people well, but also redistributing their profits and figuring out how to contribute to pooled funds where they can put money towards Black press, towards Black journalism. That's something that folks can do at a national level or at a hedge fund level. At a more local level or a more regional level, or for an independent newsroom, newsrooms can think about and take action towards having Black leadership that exists in their executive positions and in their C-suite positions. And not only having folks in those positions, but paying them equitably, treating them with care, and understanding that while they may not be the creators of anti-Blackness, that they come in that lineage and they are a part of that harm. And so long as they don't take action to shift it, they are complicit in its continuation.
Right. Well, let me finally ask Colette if you can tell us a little bit more about where people can find out the pledge, you know, maybe ask their local paper to cover it and to sign it, or if they are a journalist signing it. And also, I know that there's a documentary, Black in the Newsroom, that Media 2070 is involved in. So give us all the details of how people can find out more about your work.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have two different ways that you can sign the pledge. If you are part of a media organization, you can sign on behalf of your organization or as, you know, a person within that that particular platform. And if you are a community member that wants to see the media organizations in your community signing on to this kind of pledge to care for Black communities and journalists, you can also sign. So we have two separate ways that you can sign, and you can get to both of those at media media2070.org. That's media2070.org. You can also find our film, which Sonali mentioned, is called Black in the Newsroom, and it follows the journey of Elizabeth Montgomery, who is an incredible journalist based in Arizona, and the difficulties that she faced inside of a major newsroom in Phoenix, and how her story is actually one illustration of a very much broader dynamic of systemic media harm. And in putting a face on that harm, you know, with Elizabeth really blessing us with the opportunity to amplify her story, it's really helped for us to really create awareness in communities across the country of the pressure that we have to put on these media companies and the care that we have to demand. You know, there used to be a newsroom diversity study by a group called ASNE, and it's been around for 30 years, but so few newsrooms participate. Now they've stopped doing the study. So we know that as of 2017, American newspapers were about 5%, had about 5% African-American staff. We don't even know where we are in 2023. And so we realized that there has to be some fire lit figuratively under these media companies to get them to not only, you know, begin participating in diversity surveys and other kind of really baseline efforts like that to understand what we have on our hands, but to go many steps further and to actually care for the Black folks in their midst who are doing the hard work of telling truthful stories and holding those in power to account. So that's, you know, blackinthenewsroom.com is where you can find that film. And all of these things, like I mentioned, are housed at media2070.org.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My guests have been Colette Watson, Project Director of Media 2070, and Alicia Bell, co-creator of Media 2070. And we'll post all of those links that Colette and Alicia mentioned on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, as well as a link to the article that Colette has written for Yes Magazine. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, again, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Joe Biden has been stymied in his plans to cancel limited amounts of student debt. After making an August announcement for a cancellation of up to $20,000 in debt, depending on borrower circumstances, a lawsuit stopped the plan in its tracks. According to CNN, about 16 million people have already been approved for up to $20,000 in federal student loan forgiveness, but no debt is currently allowed to be canceled as litigation plays out. Now, the president has turned to the Supreme Court for a decision, but there's little hope, given the 6-3 conservative supermajority among justices. We turn now to Braxton Brewington, spokesperson for the Debt Collective. Welcome to the program, Braxton.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, when the announcement was made by the Biden administration, I imagine that folks like yourself might have been critical because it was a very narrow forgiveness plan, but still better than nothing. There had, as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, been pauses in repayments of student debt loans. But what was your overall impression of the original plan that Biden put forward? You know, had that plan been allowed to go forward, would you, you know, did you see that as a good first step?
It was definitely bittersweet. We have been pushing for full student debt cancellation and creating a pathway towards tuition-free college so that we don't have to go into debt for education in the first place. Warren and other progressive members of Congress were pushing for $50,000, and you know, Biden settled on $10,000 to $20,000, depending on your current situation, and also means tested it, right? It capped it at $125,000 per year income. So not exactly everything that we wanted, but a great first step and very telling, you know, sort of giving us a proof of concept that we do have leverage in terms of our organizational power and pushing the President of the United States to take action that'll actually take meaningful lives, meaningful action in people's lives. And so what we're calling for is for the Biden administration to not abide by and sort of throw their hands up in the air and say, if the court stops us, they stop us. That is, you know, we're talking about $400 billion worth of student debt relief. They need to find some other, legal creative ways to make sure that this relief gets into people's pockets.
So what now? What are the ways in which those who are burdened with student debt can move forward? I mentioned that many have already something like 16 million received approval letters, and the Biden administration presumably has sent these letters pending the legislation gridlock breaking. So at this point, what people are they supposed to continue paying those loans off? Do they pause in their payment? What other, and there are, there have been various plans on pausing repayment, depending upon whether you are a government worker or not, etc. Right? So what advice do you give to those people who are trying to figure out where they stand?
Well, just recently, hundreds of organizations put out a letter calling on the Biden administration to at the least extend the pause on federal student debt payments and interest until, the court system has sort of worked out what's going to happen with student debt. And I think that's really important.
He can do that just on his own, right? With just a stroke of a pen.
Absolutely. He can extend the pause. I think this would be the eighth or the ninth extension that he's done several times, and the Trump administration extended a couple of times. So at the least, right, people shouldn't be having to be forced to make payments on a debt that they were promised would be eliminated, right? So we're saying the pause needs to be extended, and the Biden administration should circumvent, right? So they should go around these courts and cancel debt with a different legal authority. So we've been pushing, the Higher Education Act of 1965 is not the legal authority that the Biden administration leveraged or referenced when they canceled student debt, but the HEROES authority that they use has been caught up in court. Well, there's nothing preventing from the Biden administration from saying, well, we're going to take a similar action with a different legal authority. You know, there's also a bevy of cancellation programs that are at the administration's disposal that if they wanted to sort of broaden that definition of who meets those programs, they could cancel student debt through those programs. So this is not the end all be all for student debt relief. We just need a Biden administration to spur some sense of legal creativity to make sure people get relief that, again, they've already proved people for.
Is it a matter of prioritizing it? I mean, it sounds as though you're saying Biden has tools at his disposal that he is not quite enthusiastically using yet.
Right. There are other tools at his disposal, and he should use them. It's great that the Biden administration is appealing the suit and fighting this in court, but it's just not going to be enough should a right-wing court come down with an unfavorable opinion for the Biden administration to sort of shrug or throw their hands up and say, we've done all that, we've can. There's a plethora of other options available to them to make sure that, people get this relief.
Where can people find out more, Braxton, about Debt Collective if they are saddled with student debt and they want to join in the movement and really politicize, as you were saying, this repayment of debt that they should have stopped paying a long time ago?
You can go to debtcollective.org, and there you can join the union for free or for whatever you can pay per month. You can also be in touch with a group of debtors in your area and sort of join the sort of virtual floor where you can meet other people who are often battling the same situations you are. And as long as Twitter is around, we are on @StrikeDebt on Twitter.
At Strike Debt. Thank you so much, Braxton, for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Braxton Brewington, a spokesperson for the Debt Collective. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 8th, for a full 24 hours of